I currently have two guests this morning who are collaborating on an important concert, which will be held as the first concert of the Kalamazoo Bach Festival 2018. Andrew Kohler conducts the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, and Chris Ludwig conducts the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus. There are two major works on the program, and they are significant in terms of Kalamazoo history and even North American history. So I'm really pleased to be giving listeners a preview of this concert, which is coming up June 2nd with Andrew and Chris. Welcome to WMUK.
Thanks very much, Kara. Thanks for having us.
Let's look at the planning that went into putting these two works together. First, Chris, tell us what the works are.
So we have two works. One is the Stankovich Requiem, which Andrew will talk more about, and then Walton Belshazzar's Feast. Formidable works.
Kind of
huge works, and not often or very infrequently performed because of their size and scope.
May I say that for your first season as director of the Kalamazoo Bach Festival, you bit off a lot to chew.
No lack of ambition in this guy, right?
I think it was right after I'd gotten hired. We were already talking about what we were going to do and thinking, well, and he had this idea about the Requiem and then said, well, what could we pair with that would be interesting? And this idea of this sort of dichotomy, I guess, of feast and famine and the haves and the have-nots, and the way that all plays out within power struggles was really interesting, and Belshazzar seemed like a good choice at the time, not knowing at all what the ability level of the chorus was other than what I'd interviewed for. But I've really been pleased with their work, and it's just an incredible piece and says a lot about their artistry and their musicianship as well as that of the K-Phil.
Andrew, you were also getting to know Chris as a musician and music director. I've never known you to like shy away from something that requires extra effort, a little extra determination to get it done.
Definitely not. And that's why I was so so excited when Chris made the suggestion of pairing it with the Walton. Because I just thought, oh, all right, a bold choice, sir, but I love it. I was really excited about it. And I knew also that not only are they incredibly challenging and rewarding choral parts, but also the orchestra part is immensely difficult and gives everyone a real workout, you know, really engages every person on that stage.
Well, I'd like to hear more about these pieces. It has been all over social media that, Andrew, you gave the North American premiere in Chicago of Stankovich's Requiem for Those Who Died of Famine.
Exactly, yeah.
Just last Saturday.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you know, that was sort of the kernel that I think began this entire collaborative process, because it was just a funny turn of events. I had conducted a Christmas concert about a year ago. And at that Christmas concert, I was given carte blanche to program what I wanted. And the person who allowed me to do that had said something like, well, just think of whatever Christmas means to you. And I thought, okay, well, what does it mean to me? And I thought a little bit about it. And I realized that having grown up in the Philadelphia area, one of the sounds of Christmas for me was those old Philadelphia orchestra recordings with those amazing souped-up orchestrations of traditional carols that I love. That was one of the sounds. But the other sound, surely, was the sound of the bandura, this native folk instrument of Ukraine that my parents would play old recordings of. So for me, those two were the sounds of Christmas very much. So I programmed both of those things. I found the arrangements at the Philadelphia Orchestra play. We did some of those. And then I thought, let me see if I can find some Ukrainian carols. And wouldn't it be crazy if I could find some banduristas, some people who actually played this instrument. And then on a lark, I just went online. You know, it's an amazing age we live in. What a time to be alive. And I found that there is something called the Women's Bandura Ensemble of North America, and it's based in Chicago. So I contacted them. They said, sure, we'd love to come and play some of these carols, and we'll do some of our own. It was a wonderful collaboration, and one of the members there happens to also serve on the Ukrainian Genocide Famine Foundation Board, a group that seeks to raise awareness of the Holodomor, of this genocide that happened in Ukraine in 1932, 1933. And she said, you know, our board president has had this dream for 15 years or something like that, that we could present the North American premiere of this work by Stankovic. Have you ever heard it? And I had not. I was familiar, at least distantly, with Stankovic as a composer, but I'd never heard this piece. And when I had a chance to listen to it, I was just blown away by its raw power, the immediacy of its communication. And I said, sign me up. I'm ready to do it. I'd be excited to commit the Philharmonia to it and then talk to Chris. And he shared my enthusiasm, committed the Bach Festival, which was a wonderful step. And then the rest is history. So that's how we got to Chicago last week and got to perform at Harris Theater and give the what we'll call the second part of the North American premiere here in Kalamazoo on June 2nd of this incredible work.
Tickets for this event and much more information is at KalamazooBachFestival.org. I'm with Chris Ludwa, who leads the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, and the Kalamazoo Philharmonia director, Andrew Kohler. Again, Saturday, June 2nd. It says 7 p.m. So at least on the publication I have.
That's the pre-concert.
I think the pre-concert talk is at 7 and the concert is at 8.
Okay. So,
which will really inform somebody's experience, just because they're not as familiar works. I think, you know, it's Andrew speaks so articulately about the Requiem and having had a family history there makes that so much more real. I mean, when we were in Chicago, one of the things that the singers were all struck by was, you know, just the sense of history and ownership of the Ukrainian people to this and the way that it's not, you know, just doesn't make the history books like everything else does, you know, in our current system. And so I think for them to feel the sense of that somebody really cared and had done all this work to prepare this piece. And but again, it's not something that's done that often. So having the background of the piece and as well as the Walton and that pre-concert thing is probably be really informative and helpful for somebody experiencing this for the first time.
This work commemorates a famine that resulted in millions of deaths.
Mm-hmm. Between 7 and 10, reportedly.
Well, the Soviet records are so spotty that it's been the work of decades for historians to try and piece together who it might be. Estimates have initially been as high as 14 million and now center around 5 million, and others still insist that it might be around 10. So you can see there's an enormous range. But at any rate, I mean, at the very lowest number is 5 million deaths.
So what if 5 million people died and no one noticed until much later.
Yeah.
This work is called Requiem for Those Who Died of Famine by Stankovic, and I did have his first name, Yevhen. Yevhen. Mm-hmm. Does this work come first or second on the program?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We debated this question because it is such a... I think an amazingly powerful emotive experience, not that the Walton isn't also, but the Walton ends in celebration. And there is a distant sort of tinge of optimism that ends the Stankovic. And ultimately, because of that, I think because of the gravity of what it's describing, and because that's a nearer history and perhaps a less well-known one, we've opted to finish the program with the Stankovic and start with the Walton.
Okay, well, let's start with Feast and move to Famine. Chris, tell me your experience if you have a live performance experience with it, or, you know...
This is one of those you only do in your, you know, your studies.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then you decide you want to tackle it, and so then really jumping in with the choir and
William
with the
Walton was... Yeah. It was a British composer, early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Sir William Walton, even.
William. His lifespan would sort of overlap with Stankovic a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. And his, you know, I mean, he's really, most of the performances you find of this are done by British groups. There's there's a real sense of pride in his work.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the jokes was that a friend of his had come to the, I guess it was a reading of it or something like that, and heard the piece and said, well, you know, why don't you just throw in a few extra brass bands? And the guy said, oh, well, that's a great idea. So then he did, you know. So it's just mammoth in terms of, you know, it has a semi-chorus and double chorus and this huge soloist movements that, you know, sort of dictates or narrates the piece. Plus at 85 person orchestra, which is even paired back in our case. I mean, our brass players are doing both of the offstage bands because, you know, who has the resources for that? But no shortage of power even without those two offstage bands.
Would you help me with my literature knowledge? Who was Belshazzar and why did he have a feast?
Right. So fascinating story. I think the narrator, Stefan, in this case, you know, sort of plays the role of Daniel telling the story. Belshazzar was the son of Nebuchadnezzar and essentially was, you know, one of these kings that had all the power and all of the resources and essentially kind of exiled and imprisoned all the Israelites at the same time as he was throwing this lavish party for himself with trumpets and brass and iron and silver. And, you know, it's very much like, I mean, so many things that he repeat in history in terms of this theme of the ones with the power. And so that's kind of a fascinating cautionary tale, I guess, to it. But then the story of the writing on the wall, when somebody says, oh, you're reading the writing on the wall, is that after he'd thrown this party, reportedly this hand appeared on the wall behind him and essentially said, you'll be judged by your acts. I'm paraphrasing.
And found wanting.
Yes, and found wanting. Yes, not going to go well for you. And so so the choir articulates this entire thing. And then at that point, later that night, he's slain in this really dramatic moment in the piece where the chorus, and now we've added the orchestra, shouts slain. And then there's this great celebrating and rejoicing that Andrew mentioned earlier as the Israelites are freed, along with little snippets of musical kernels from before that, and different key areas that sort of signify various people or characters in this narrative.
It sounds like this is a work, Belshazzar's Feast by William Walton, a work where you almost have to cast your characters in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the baritone that so the baritone will be telling this story?
I'm going to ask Aaron Andrew to help me with his last name pronunciation so I don't screw it up.
Oh, it's Stefan Szkaforowski.
Who is this individual?
So Stefan is a former Met singer that we've brought in, and he came in for the performance in Chicago and then went back to New York, and then he's coming in this next week for masterclass as well as the performances with us. So
he's an amazingly gifted singer. He's really a bass, although of course he has a mm-hmm. tremendous range and can handle lots of different parts. Yes, as Chris says, he's sung at the Met, he's sung at the Lyric, he's sung at all major opera houses around the world, and he happens to be an American with Ukrainian origins, which is why we were so especially interested in having him for the Ukrainian Requiem, in which he plays the role both of a bass soloist, but also of a true narrator, meaning actually speaking text. And there's so much of this text that's rendered in Ukrainian that it's would be quite difficult for someone to learn it if they didn't already speak the language.
Will be accompanied by super titles at Genry, I will add. Correct. So that, you know, if you're not a Ukrainian speaker, as 99.9% of us are,
yes.
That you'll not be lost or frankly staring down at your program. You should be able to look up and really experience the piece and all of its drama.
Well, this very special performance featuring a guest artist who is a bass baritone with Ukrainian origins. This takes place June 2nd in Chenry Auditorium and is the kickoff to the Kalamazoo Bach Festival, which lightens up considerably after this. Yeah. This is a big splash.
Nowhere to go but lighter after that. Yeah. Although, I mean, I would also say that it's, I mean, even in its gravitas, it's still... it's not so heavy that there are not moments of really feeling a sense of joy and resolution, you know, for both pieces. I think yes. A sense of that some things do, that resolution can be found in serenity, acceptance, I guess, of mm-hmm. what's occurred.
Chris, could we hear something from Belshazzar's
yes.
Feast?
Yes, let's hear track 6. This is essentially this happens midway through the piece, but it articulates kind of what this party that Belshazzar was throwing. It talks about the feast and the wine and how they're basically using these sacred vessels of the Israelites for this party and essentially just kind of...
desecrating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then from that, in this particular place, the chorus can either be seen as representing the Belshazzar's minions, his supporters. In our interpretation, we've been sort of talking to the chorus about what would it be like if you were enslaved, if you were the Israelites that were enslaved, but forced to sing these songs of praise to Belshazzar. So even though you're enslaved, you're still, paying homage, at least in word. And that creates an additional level of drama for the chorus. So I think track 6 is a great one.
Wow, that's music of William Walton, and I wasn't prepared for how fierce
the bombastic
choir sounded. If you like rock and roll, this matches that sort of wild power.
Yeah, extremely rhythmic and angular and in some ways off-putting, but then balanced by this sort of beautiful moments where you really hear this sense of massive resolution, at least in depending on who's singing at the various times.
This is a moral story about a man living to excesses and hurting people around him and his ultimate judgment. Mm-hmm. And as we were listening to this segment, it's in the middle of the full piece, which mm-hmm. takes 25, 30 minutes or so.
35.
And as we were talking during the music, Chris, you said he meets his end very soon.
Yes, soon after this, there's a recit with the bass soloist. Much of the bass soloist stuff is essentially unaccompanied, so it's very much like a recit would normally be, where you're just trying to get a lot of information across quickly on the text, and then the chorus and orchestra shout that he was slain. And then there's this sort of huge buildup of rejoicing after that.
Which is the entire rest of the piece?
Pretty much. Well, yeah, but with these little, so it's not just all joy from there. There's little places where it harkens back and it's like, but he was slain. And then, more partying. So it's like they never forget, what had occurred before. I think it's the sort of that cautionary tale piece of, what happens when we take things that are somehow sacred and
the Israelites are still exiled, right? I mean, they're still not home. They still, right. I think, have that sense of homesickness and nostalgia, and that sometimes wafts through those later passages in this generally celebratory mm-hmm. atmosphere.
Could we have a little segment here on nuts and bolts of putting this piece together? Chris, how long has the choir been working on Belshazzar's
roughly
feast?
8 weeks or so, a little more than that maybe, but it's definitely been, the kind of thing where there's no way to possibly get all of the learning that needs to happen done in the rehearsal time that we have. So almost every week there has been either before or after rehearsal, me sitting down at a piano and then taking chunks of this and trying to explain the music theory behind what is Walton doing at any given moment. Like, this chord moves from E flat to C, and then it goes from C to B. And it's the kind of stuff that, because the language of Walton's writing is so much less conventional than Mozart or Brahms or something like that, it's not as familiar to the choir. And so that kind of musical context has really been necessary for them to understand what the heck is happening. How do I get my notes seemingly out of the blue. And once you start to figure out his language, then it's like, oh, okay, I kind of get where he's going with this. And there are various themes that come back for various characters and harmonic sequences that come back here and there. And so once you understand it, but there's no way to get all of that out in the rehearsal. So it's like, you know, there's usually a 20 or 30 minute recording that I'll make, you know, and then send it out as an MP3 to the choir, which then they listen to. And, you know, so you can get all of those contextual things out there that you otherwise could never have enough time to rehearse. We'd have to double the number of rehearsals we had, I think, to get all that in.
Oh, that's wonderfully satisfying as a musician to take something that doesn't make a lot of sense and find the patterns and keys mm-hmm. to it, going from chaos to an integrated understanding of a
yeah.
piece.
Yeah.
So that's how you build not only how to sing it, but how to understand it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, Walton, he really stretched the limits of what vocal ranges, conventional vocal ranges. I mean, one of our altos actually said, did this guy ever know an alto? Because, you know, like the vocal range of this stuff is so high that it's in some places just really, really difficult. But we've also found that it's really stretched the choir in some really great ways and, you know, gotten them out of their comfort zone and expanded their own range in terms of what they can sing. So that's really, it's been a rewarding experience, not just musically in terms of understanding his language and the theory behind it, but also just the technical abilities of the singers, I think, has gone up as a result.
Performing with the two groups together doesn't take place until well after rehearsal periods have started. So, Andrew, you could address what the orchestra looked at in order to best be the foundation for this piece while the singers came in.
Yeah, well, we've had a similar trajectory, I'd say. I mean, we've also been at work on both of these pieces for about 8 weeks now. And obviously, in any orchestral piece, there's always the expectation there has to be a lot of outside work. People have to come and have practiced and really spend some time with the part and listen to it before they try and put it together so that we can be as efficient as possible in those rehearsals, focusing our energies on things like ensemble and style and, you know, better sort of communal rhythm rather than just sort of like, oh, what note is that that you're playing there? Let's fix that. So it's been a tremendously big challenge. On the side, of course, I work with the students in individual, well, not quite individual, but small group sectionals, you know, the ones who are students at K College, and we make sure we pull them out and do a little work. And then within some of the rehearsals, we also have sectionals. So, you know, just the first violins work with their section leader and so on and so forth, so that you can get some more sort of detailed approaches to the individual challenges or the unique challenges of any given part in the orchestra. But the other thing that one has to stress is flexibility. You know, in the end, I've been preparing the orchestra as Chris has been preparing the chorus, and then we both conduct one of these works on the concert. So the chorus has to get used to me in the Stankovic, and the orchestra has to get used to Chris in the Walton. And that's a big shift. You know, Chris will come and say, you know, I want to do this passage maybe in a dictate a different meter than the one that I had thought would work for the passage, you know, and he feels that there's a better way to get it, or it gets at something that the chorus is singing that feels better for them. So that's an adjustment that needs to be made, or simply tempi that are different, especially the Walton. I was remarking to a student the other day that the Walton is a piece, I can think of very few pieces that have such a substantive length, like of this 35 minutes, but spend so much of it being fast. You know, because usually that length is achieved by extended slower passages in much of classical music. But so much of this music is fast and then just gets faster. Walton seems to have a sort of fetish almost for accelerandos, for speeding up the tempo. So half of the tempis begin in one already quite vivacious pace and then just keep ramping up as it goes on and on.
There's a part in the score I could add it to that. So Andrew had gotten the score from the publisher first, and then they only sent one, of course. And so, you know, you do what you need to do. And but I was looking at the marking that was there, and it was literally like, so one of the markings that we'll put in a score is an arrow pointing forward or to the right, which suggests an accelerando. And it was like five pages of arrows to the right. You know, this thing gets faster and faster and faster.
So yeah. The adrenaline is sort of baked into the piece.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I That would be quite a thrill to perform and to listen to, of course. Yeah. Why don't we hear one more section?
Yeah, let's hear the conclusion of Belshazzar. So at this point, he's dead. We've slain him, and the Israelites, as Andrew said, are still wandering and not really found home, but are, I think, they've in the early part of the piece, there's this text about, you know, by the waters of Babylon, we sat down, we hanged up our harps. And so there's this sort of, that's their, at this point, even though they're in exile still, I think there's this sense of, but they have their voice back. They're able to sing their songs again, even wherever they are in exile. Whereas before, again, in our interpretation, they're having to sing these songs for Belshazzar and pretend as if they are, you know, paying homage to him and honoring him. So I think that's significant here as the end. So this is the last little track of this. I'll get in the text poetically arranged, but from the book of Revelation here at the very end. So this is then sing aloud to God our strength.
The crowds are in for a treat on June 2nd when the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus joins up with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia to perform Belshazzar's Feast by William Walton. And the two leaders of these groups are here in the studio with me at WMUK. I can't get over the power in that music. It just, you're right, it just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah. How bigger, exciting. Faster, better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You did mention brass requirements for this piece. Have you recruited additional brass players, or is there the sections are pretty beefy?
Yeah, no, I mean the brass playing that's already in the regular orchestra is pretty immense, and we, I think, needed also to be practical about balancing with a chorus and space constraints in Chenery, et cetera, et cetera. As it worked out, Chris told that story. It was the conductor of the festival for which this was written who said that, I think they were doing at that same festival the Berlioz Requiem, which does call for many additional brass. And the conductor said to Walton, "Well, my dear boy, since no one will ever hear this music again, why don't you go ahead and add some brass bands to it?" So he did, but he did name them optional. And in fact, a lot of what they play can be cross-cued in the regular trumpet parts. So we've opted to take a deep breath and just step one small step back and not use the extra brass, but just have our regular trumpet section sort of cover what's the vast majority of what's there already.
As I mentioned before, a lot of the musicians who are playing a part in this concert, which premiered last week in Chicago, have been expressing their appreciation and almost gratitude for being part of it on Facebook and social media. It's a significant part of what they do, but I think for listeners too, the opportunity to hear Belshazzar's Feast and the North American premiere of the Requiem by Stankovic is just not going to happen again, possibly for decades or even in our lifetimes. So
it would rarely happen in a town this size. I mean, I think that's, you know, just another testament to Kalamazoo and the resources here and the highly educated and artistically sensible audiences of this region. It's just, as well as the arts supporters, it's just phenomenal that you could pull off both of these in a town this size.
The concert will begin, music will begin at 8 p.m. in Chanery Auditorium on June 2nd, Saturday, June 2nd. There will be pre-concert information and a talk at 7 o'clock for ticket holders who come a little earlier. There's details online as well, kalamazoobachfestival.org. Time now to look a little more closely at the Requiem for Those Who Died of Famine by Stankovic, who was born in 1942 and is still with us today.
He is. I've had the distinct pleasure of speaking to him a few times over Skype. And in fact, you know, we, Chris and I, along with some of our colleagues at Kalamazoo College, collaborate on teaching a senior seminar. And the Stankovic is the work that we looked at really in depth in the senior seminar. And he was even gracious enough to speak with my class as I did my level best to try and simultaneously translate what he was saying.
Because he was, of course, speaking in his native
Ukrainian. Yes.
Mm-hmm. He is a well-known composer in Ukraine.
Yes.
Has written a number of, he composes works for stage, orchestra, chamber works, choral works.
Yeah.
So he has long been a musical force.
Absolutely. Yeah. When the Soviet Union was still around, he was the head of the Ukrainian Composers Union. And now he is the distinguished sort of head professor of composition at the Tchaikovsky Conservatory in Kiev, which is the biggest conservatory in Ukraine. So he's certainly a very well-regarded and well-known composer in his native Ukraine. And he has the title, as many of the best musicians in Ukraine do, of they call it Narodny Artist, like artist of the people.
By listening to this work and maybe some of his others, what do you think are some of the influences that formed his outlook as a composer?
You know, even in our discussions, he frequently made reference to some of the people that would have been partially in his orbit, people like Dmitri Shostakovich, he has mentioned, you know, he spoke about him in terms of sort of an anecdote about him, but I think I can hear parts of Shostakovich in there. There's no question that there's some Mahler in there. There's no question that there's some Stravinsky as well in the sort of overt percussiveness of the way that he uses the orchestra at certain times. I think one of the most fascinating things about the trajectory of his music, though, and it's true not only of his music, but that of many other Eastern Europeans, is that once Stalin died and there was the Khrushchev took over and there was a bit of a thaw in the way that composers could compose. Stalin, of course, famously for Shostakovich, had really insisted, no, you've got to compose in this very accessible idiom. And if you try and do anything too modern sounding, that'll be real trouble for you. Once Stalin passed, that relaxed a little bit. And some composers really went quite far from that, especially those in the satellite states, the Soviet bloc states, places like Poland. And they composed in a very overtly avant-garde manner that was very deeply influenced by the Second Viennese School. So, you know, very atonal. This was true of Stankovic's music as well, especially his earlier music. And I spoke to him and he said, near the end of the Soviet Union, so it wasn't exactly timed with it, but near the end, he said, I started reading the Bible. He started getting really interested in the physical sciences. He said he was studying physics and things like this. And he said he concluded that music had to speak more directly to the soul of human beings. And like some Polish composers, like Arvo Pärt in Estonia and like Henryk Gorecki in Poland, his music took a rather dramatically simplified turn. That is to say, it once again re-embraced tonality and a kind of almost mystical spiritual element that was put on display. And I think in a way, the Requiem, or more accurately, Panahida, because it's not a Requiem, refers, of course, to the Catholic tradition. It's the one that's maybe closest to us, it's the word we know, but Panahida is the equivalent of a requiem in the Orthodox tradition, and that is what this is in the end. This piece, I think, is a kind of compendium of everything he's done, because there are moments in it that are overtly brash and dissonant and have a kind of roughness, appropriately so, when he's sort of fuming in rage at what happened. But then there are moments of religious acceptance as well, and pleading with God, and those moments are often much more richly tonal and sound, have that warmth of a much earlier age of music. So it really spans the gamut.
I think that's an extraordinary development for him, based on the fact he was born in 1942. I would say probably between 1960 and the late 80s, he was writing in a tough to inaccessible sort of style,
yes,
or in a modern avant-garde style. Mm-hmm. And after almost 30 years of writing like that, took a complete left turn and a reassessment of what music is and about. And
I think it's also, in a lot of ways, even though he has made reference to his former colleagues, laughing at him and saying that he must have fallen on his head or something like that, he said in one of our interviews. I think it takes a certain kind of courage, you know, a certain principled artistic conviction. We are all social beings. We all feel that pressure. You know, once you've sort of established yourself as a certain kind of artist, you run in certain kinds of circles and you sort of feel like, well, that's who I am. But to be able to look so inwardly and say to yourself, no, I think this is the direction that my art wants to go now, and to have the courage of your conviction to go in that way, then I think that speaks to the mark of a true artist.
Well, let's speak about the historic events that prompted this work, ones that, as an American, I just don't know anything about, but I am guessing this impacted his life.
I'm certain. I did not speak specifically with him on this point, but I certainly would not be surprised. The truth is that the vast majority of Ukrainians, probably at least those who lived in central and eastern Ukraine, would have had a relative somewhere along the line that would have been affected by this, because it affected that many people.
What are the facts of this that we do have?
So when the Soviet Union was founded, of course, as a communist state, there was an initial push to collectivize agriculture. That is to say, to make all farms owned directly by the state, so that the food, the traditional idea that someone works the land and then saves some food for himself to eat and then perhaps sells the rest, was no longer the case. All of that belonged to the state. The state would divvy up those resources. Food is power. I mean, those who have it, those who can control it, those are the people who can be in power. So initially, Lenin tried to collectivize the farms, and a famine occurred, and he lost his nerve, and he sort of rolled it back. This was the first five-year plan to collectivize the farms. And when he saw it wasn't working and he worried about an uprising, he said, it's too soon. And then Stalin later decided, after Lenin had died and after he had seized pretty much complete power, that he would try this again. When he did this, and when another famine occurred, he decided that the reason for this famine was sabotage. And here it would be a good time to point out that the vast majority of grain that was grown for the Soviet Union was in Ukraine. Ukraine was always thought of itself as a grain-growing place. It has extremely fertile soil. Was often colloquially referred to as the breadbasket of Europe or the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. So just a huge percentage of the food that was eaten anywhere in the Soviet Union came from Ukraine. So as Soviet agronomists had a tendency to do, they figured, well, now that we're collectivizing and now that we've put a couple tractors out there, so we're modernizing the forces, we can expect that the grain yields will be so high. And they set them at artificially, inflatedly high levels. When they weren't met, Stalin assumed sabotage on the part of Ukrainians, because there was no other way that something could happen other than sabotage. Of course, it was kulaks, the landowners. This became an epithet, a really sort of dirty word. You know, that was the most dangerous thing you could be, a landowner. They were trying to sabotage the new communist system. And so he targeted those people in the most vicious way possible, using the full apparatus of the Soviet state. The food was requisitioned. Anything that was not meeting the quota was taken from people. So the end game after about a year of starvation was that by the end, Soviet authorities were taking food from hiding places. They were digging it up out of the ground. It was suspect if you weren't starving to death. They closed the border so people couldn't even flee Ukraine. They couldn't go to other places. Those few who managed in the earlier stages to get out suddenly noticed as soon as they crossed the border into Russia or into Belarus that no one was starving, that this was only happening in Ukraine, and this was specifically targeted at Ukrainians. Many people also feel that because at the founding of the Soviet Union, Ukraine had indicated many nationalistic impulses, that they weren't interested necessarily in joining the larger Soviet Union, but wanted to be a sovereign nation, that they were a danger to the ability for Russia to get its food, because that's where they relied on getting their food from. So in one swift stroke, by starving millions of people to death in the most horrendous way possible, Stalin sought to quell a nationalistic spirit in Ukraine, and also make sure that he very clearly made the point that this food belonged to the Soviet state and not it to any individual.
This occurred over a period of years, decades?
The height of the famine was between 1932 and 1933. So that's really when the Holodomor was remembered. After that, Stalin sent a lot of ethnic Russians to live in those lands that were now depopulated and to continue farming the land.
Echoes of modern day politics and maneuvers.
There's absolutely no coincidence that that eastern Ukrainian part is the one that is most Russian leaning and the one that Russia is seeking to retake right now.
This performance is the North American premiere of Requiem for Those Who Died of Famine by Stankovich, and it's set for Saturday, June 2nd. We have a few minutes left in this hour to hear at least part of the piece. I'd like to have your final thoughts this hour, and then you could introduce perhaps what we might hear in this excerpt from a live performance. I'll start with you, Chris, to hear anything we may have forgotten to tell listeners.
I just think it's such a joy to do something that people haven't heard, and yet which, as you pointed out on the break, you know, has or when we were listening to the piece, has all the accessibility of John Williams or Carl Orff or other composers that are more familiar, and then to be doing something that is so, as you just pointed out now, relevant. I just, the two of these pieces have really been such a great journey for the choir and the orchestra and our board and I expect for the audience, in terms of just seeing something that is so history repeating itself in various ways and just has a lot of wisdom that we might not make the same mistakes again.
Andrew.
What I said to the orchestra and the chorus in these last 2 days after we returned from our performance in Chicago was, I made an analogy that feeling you have when you bring a friend over to your families and you really like this friend and you want to introduce him to the family, but you're a little embarrassed by your family and at the same time hoping somehow you'll all get along. And on some epic scale, that's what it felt like to take the orchestra and the chorus to this group of Ukrainians and perform this music that's so deeply meaningful to Ukraine. And it means the world to me, because this is, these are two halves of my self-identity, the musician half and the Ukrainian half, coming together and to find acceptance and enthusiasm even, and openness, open hearts and minds from the singers and the players to say, we hear what this part of your culture is and we embrace it, is a truly humbling and moving experience, and I'm so excited that we got a chance to make this collaboration and to share it with the audience in Kalamazoo on June 2nd.
Details and tickets are available online right now at KalamazooBachFestival.org. This is a recording, the only existing recording. It's a live performance that was held in Ukraine, right?
Yes, that's right, in Western Ukraine, in the city of Lviv. And I'll just briefly say that we begin with a movement of great rage. You'll hear an excerpt where the narrator speaks, which is another very important feature of this music. And then finally, we get to one of those more accepting parts. We hear a prayer from the chorus that's using the Orthodox liturgy. And then finally, a soprano solo taking the guise of a child, singing to its mother and saying, soon I will die. Please don't kill yourselves out of grief, because I want to make sure that you can join me in heaven.